It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about nanomedicine for the diagnosis of COVID-19 and influenza and what infection sensors mean for the testing marketplace. Call in with a question, your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Deji Akinwande is an electrical and computer engineering professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Deji, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, good morning, Kate. Thank you for inviting us to discuss this technology.
Yes, and together with you, Dimitri Kariv, a UT Austin postdoctoral fellow. Dimitri, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Kate. Happy to be here.
So, Deji, let's start with you. Can you provide us with a visual description of this infection sensor that is in development?
Yes, basically, during the pandemic, it became clear to us that we could contribute technology, especially in terms of diagnostics. So the idea was to make something that was, USB compatible. You could, maybe plug it into your USB power supply, and it would have some sensor devices using nanomaterials, and you would put a drop of either saliva or nasal swab and put a drop on the sensor. And in a few seconds or so, the sensor could tell you whether you have COVID and which particular variant you may have, or whether you have flu, which particular variant, or whether you have none of the above. So a very simple, easy to use, but yet accurate, rapid testing platform.
So the sample that you're working with is saliva in this instance?
Well, in the beginning, we weren't quite sure what the sensitivity of this technology would be. For saliva, you require a much more sensitive sensor. It turns out that our sensor device for detecting COVID is very sensitive. So it can sense from saliva samples. In fact, it could even sense from samples that are liquefied from breath.
Wow, that's amazing. Dimitri, can you explain how this technology works? What is happening on the sensor when the sample is placed on it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So very briefly, we're using this nanomaterial called graphene, and that's, a wonder material. It's an atomically thin, so it is literally one atom thin. That is, let's say 10,000 times thinner than the human hair. And the wonderful property of that material is that it is electrochemically sensitive to, anything with a charge. And biological molecules such as virus, they have a charge, electrical charge associated with it. So we build up a small biosensor device that consists of, graphene nanomaterial and a few biomolecular functionalization steps to make sure that we can sense a specific virus.
So graphene, you said, is that like the building block of graphite?
That's exactly the case. Yes, it's one of the allotrope or one of the subversion of graphite. So you pretty much can find it in your pencil.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to introduce you here for a moment, talking about the development of a new infection sensor aiming to detect COVID-19 and the flu. At the same time, we have Deji Akinwande and Dimitri Kariv. They're researchers on the project at University of Texas at Austin. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. DJ, where in the developmental stages is this sensor? Where are you at with it?
Yes, Kate, that's a very timely question. So we've now passed what I would say is the proof of concept stage. Proof of concept stage is where we conduct experiments in laboratory facilities here at the University of Texas. So those experiments have been successful. And now we need to go to what I would say is a pilot phase. In the pilot phase, then we need a lot more clinic. We need a variety of clinical samples, do blind testing of different kinds of clinical samples. And that requires much more collaboration with, I would say, medical facilities. So after the pilot phase is when this sort of data can then be presented to the FDA for approval. So I would say the next phase would be this pilot phase.
It makes me wonder, because there are so many tests out there, what that path will be like for full FDA approval, since so many of these tests in COVID era were emergency use authorization. Like, how do you get the full FDA clearance?
Yes, that's a complex question. At the moment, I think most of the sensor technologies are still pursuing this emergency use authorization first, mm-hmm. Especially with the emergence of different variants of this virus, because the full FDA authorization takes much longer time and it has to satisfy much more requirements.
Dimitri, why develop an infection sensor with nanomaterials? Why at this scale?
Well, it's this combination of, you know, the nanomaterial, you know, sensitivity. So, you know, you could make, there are different kinds of sensors in the world, you know, optical, electrical, etc. The point of using nanomaterials specifically here is that, imagine this nanomaterial, you know, as a material, all of its atoms and the whole structure is exposed to your environment. It's like those nanomaterials present by itself, by design, by the way they are made, the kind of nature, the naturally designed sensors, so they can literally sense anything that comes close to it with a charge. And we have shown with our specific work, with this proof of concept work, that our sensors are extremely sensitive, you know, in this case for COVID and flu.
I think it's important to see the distinction here. You're talking about charges, electrical charges, and I wonder why might therapeutics involving electrical charges at the, you know, nanoscale be this promising opposed to using chemistry and chemical processes to make breakthroughs in testing and diagnosis?
Well, it is, I guess, slightly a little bit more complex. It is kind of also chemical here.
Okay.
So this interaction between virus and the nanomaterial is chemical. There is a chemical reaction that happens there, but it is also electrical charge that is associated with that. So it's a complex electrochemical reaction.
I wonder then, Deji, can, you know, what about the costs of creating technology like this and being this sensitive and the materials involved? Is it viable economically to be mass produced?
Yes, that's a very, very relevant question, especially if you want this to be a mass technology. So when it comes to the question of cost, it's usually a matter of scale, scaling up manufacturing facilities to be able to produce this. Fortunately for this material, graphene, this has been undergoing development for the last, almost 20 years now. So there's now facilities in several parts of America where they're making this material at a big scale. And so, in fact, we partner with some of those facilities to get this material. So I'm confident that in terms of cost, with enough scale, you can talk about something that would be less than, you know, would be a few dollars, you know, per sensor. That's approximately the target price that I would imagine this could be produced at scale.
We have UT Austin electrical and computer engineering researchers Deji Akinwande and Dimitri Kariv on the breakthroughs in nanomedicine and this infection sensor development. Call in with your questions along the way. Your comments welcome at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the possibilities with nanomaterials-based sensors that can detect flu, COVID-19, much more quickly than current conventional tests. Join the conversation about nanotherapeutics and the possibilities. Call in with a question, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have UT Austin Electrical and Computer Engineering Professor Deji Akinwande and postdoctoral fellow Dimitri Kariv. They are explaining their efforts on this. Dimitri, can you share how researchers test the infection device? Like, does testing involve working with live viruses?
Oh, that is an excellent question. And shortly at this stage, no. And to really work with a live virus, we would need a very specific biological safety laboratory, level 3, which are only a handful in the country available. So we have been testing instead. There are inactivated virus available, so we've been testing on the inactivated virus eventually. But we've started with pretty much testing validity of our device on these associated proteins. So if you look into the whole virus, it's a huge, you know, biological molecule. But the important part, there are a few specific proteins on its surface that are actually associated with viral intake and kind of the way that this virus attaches to the human host body. And those proteins were distinguished very early in the pandemic by worldwide efforts. And so we are focusing on those proteins mainly.
How does understanding the human body's reaction to viruses, even trace amounts, I mean, how does that further your team's research development?
Well, that is very important. It is very important to stay on top of the research and what's going on and to really understand of how the virus interacts, because we've seen there are also many varieties of the virus, right? So the Omicron and Delta. So, and there are different antibodies that are more specific to certain variants of the virus. And we actually have a follow-up work that is currently ongoing as well to build a biosensor that would actually differentiate not only between COVID and flu, but between different variants of COVID to really say quickly which of the variants is the person exposed to.
There are so many new possibilities that you can imagine there. Deji, you know, what are the ramifications of the confusions of people who think they have influenza, think they have COVID-19? Did you see the confluence of that in the pandemic?
Yes, this ultimately was the motivation for our study, and this work was supported by the National Science Foundation exactly for this reason, because during the pandemic, the consequence of misdiagnosis, could be severe, and in some cases could be fatal, because for the flu, the procedure for treatment and the prognosis was much more positive than, for example, for COVID. So someone that might be suffering from COVID but misdiagnosed as flu, that could have severe consequences. Likewise, someone having flu but then diagnosed for COVID could be subject to more stringent treatment, isolation that they may not have to experience if they were properly diagnosed for flu. So these sort of things have serious consequences, not just for the person's prognosis, but also in terms of their well-being, isolation from their loved ones and society.
Prognosis also really hinging on accuracy and time. On the issue of time, how is this infection sensor, able to make a diagnosis in seconds?
Yes, Kate, it's so wonderful that you asked that question, because the current testing guidelines from the CDC, for example, for COVID, encourages people to wait for a few days so that there is enough material to sense with the conventional PCR test. And that's because the PCR test is not very sensitive. So you need to build up enough of this COVID particles for it to be successful in testing. With our platform, because we are much more sensitive, orders of magnitude more sensitive, this type of biosensor rapid test can be used even at the very outset of symptoms, and there's no need to wait several days, and it still maintains very high accuracy. So that's actually the best time is to diagnose something right at the beginning before it builds strength, so that one could stop the virus from proliferating either within the person or within the community. So we think this will enable so-called preventative testing in individuals and in communities, this type of rapid testing.
Dimitri, what are your insights in the lab on accuracy and rapid testing? The FDA saying all rapid diagnostic tests carry a risk of false positive and false negative results. What are your insights through the infection sensor?
Right, that is a fantastic question. And that's something we've been asking ourselves as well. You know, how can we make our biosensor not only be, you know, quick, fast, that we have shown that our reaction, the reaction time, you know, from dropping a liquid on the sensor to the reaction is within 10 seconds, but how can we make sure that this is, you know, true positive or true negative? And the way we've approached this is to create a small array of, you know, micro sensors on a single device. And each of those sensors, so let's say we'll have four of them, and one will be specific for COVID, one will be specific for flu, and there will be a few of them that are control. So one of them, let's say, will give us, you know, if we see a reaction on, you know, number three, means it's a false positive. On if we see the reaction on device number four, it's a false negative. So by engineering our device from kind of having a single reaction sensor, we build up, we engineer a little bit more complex solution. It's not that much more complex to make it. It's just, but we need to build it up specifically to make sure that we can correctly, truly differentiate with control between false positives and false negatives.
Talking about the development of a new infection sensor and the work underway at UT Austin detecting COVID-19 and the flu simultaneously, Deji Akinwande is here. Dimitri Kadiv, researchers on the project, join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Deji, I want to circle back to graphene, and, you know, it's been considered a disruptive technology, and I'm just wondering, what is its potential in biomedicine, in therapeutics, and what you're doing in the future as you further this virus research and testing?
Yes, graphene is one of this, say, unusual materials that transcend many applications and many industries. It's kind of the equivalent of, let's say, steel. It can be used very broadly from electronics to biomedicine. So we've also done some work. You can use graphene, for example, as a pacemaker inside the body. That's some of our recent work. Others have shown that you can also place it on the skin to measure vital signs such as blood pressure. That's also among our recent work. And so this material basically almost is limitless in its potential because it can sense charge, it can respond to pressure, it can respond to light, it is very sensitive for chemical reactions, it can be used for mechanical applications, it's biocompatible, so you can place it inside the body, you can create holes in it so that you can do DNA sequencing. So it's really limited by the imagination, to be quite frank.
That must be really exciting to you as a researcher and seeing so many possibilities.
Indeed, indeed. And so this material has continued to experience growth In terms of the number of patents that are filed every year for innovation across many, many industries.
Thank you both for joining us.
Yes, it's been a pleasure, Kate.
Thank you for inviting.
Deji Akinwande is an electrical and computer engineering professor at University of Texas at Austin. Dimitri Karif is a UT Austin postdoctoral fellow. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a specific type of poetry.
Shijo is a form of poetry that originated in Korea about 700 years ago. And today, it's gaining popularity right here in Wisconsin, as educators have established an annual Wisconsin Shijo competition. Sami Kim recently talked with some of the organizers about their love of the art form.
Clouds stand still. They look painted on the canvas of the blue sky. Soft grass tickles my arms and legs. Birds chirp loud. Not loud enough to drown out the screams and yelling of my parents inside the house. Shijo is a three-line poetic form out of Korea. I am Elizabeth Jorgensen. I've taught at Arrowhead Union High School for the past 18 years. There's a theme. Line one is the introduction. Line two is the development. And then line three always has a twist and then a conclusion.
So it was a popular form of poetry among the literary elite, often used to express the struggles of everyday life. I'm Lucy Park, one of the founders and the executive director of the Sejong Cultural Society. There is a basic fixed format. It is very rhythmical. And even now, we made some Sejo songs into a hip-hop.
They say go return to land it. I don't know, it makes no sense. Born and raised American, so Mexico is still a boy.
Everything my students do in my classroom, we send to writers' markets. And that's where I came upon the Sejong Cultural Society. They host a Shijo competition. Dr. Lucy Park reached out to me and she said, whatever you're doing in your classroom is working.
In 2008, Harvard University contacted the Sejong Cultural Society and suggested starting a Shijo competition for pre-college students. This was the first time we learned that Shijo poetry could be written in English. It was a truly enlightening experience for us.
My students were doing really well. They were placing in the Sejong Cultural Society's competition. You have no idea where it's going to lead you. But if you put in effort, those rewards are going to be bigger than anything you could ever have imagined for yourself.
So I wrote a Shijo poem about the moon. And then I thought about my mother and father. My mother passed away, and my dad passed away. Moon. I saw the pale crescent moon when I learned of mom's passing. Half moon smudged by the night cloud gazed at me when dad departed. Dear moon, with your caressing smile, who are you comforting tonight? 어머니 떠나신 날 쳐다본 창백한 초승달. 아버지 가신 날에 본 얼룩진 반달. 오늘 밤 온화한 미소로 저 달은 누굴 위로하나.
How can we get people to know and appreciate East Asian culture? And I had said, you know, what about Shijo? Could it be our window?
So for children, we want to educate them to become a global citizen. We can bridge the gaps that divide us.
Saemi Kim brought us that story on Shijo, a traditional Korean poetry form. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to this question, which are the most heart-healthy diets? The American Heart Association scores 10 popular diets on a scale from 1 to 100 and how they promote heart health. Call in about diets, ask a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Maya Vadivelu is an associate professor of nutrition and food sciences at University of Rhode Island, leading the Big Data and Eating Decisions Lab. Maya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So 10 popular diets scrutinized. Why does the American Heart Association want these diets evaluated?
Well, that's a great question. So last year, the American Heart Association put out some long updated guidance on what food groups really represent from evidence the heart healthiest patterns. And, you know, while we tried to keep it as 10 relatively simple principles to adopt, a lot of questions come up from clinicians, from patients, from clients, and just from the general public about, well, that sounds great, but I heard this, and this is what I follow. Does that align?
But what about?
Exactly. So we ended up looking at what are the most popular patterns that people are following? How are they really defined? So, how are they intended to be followed? And then do they align with that guidance so that people can kind of translate it more to their everyday lives?
Do you think there is a concern from the association and registered dietitians that Americans might not fully understand the health risks with the diets they take up?
I mean, I think absolutely. There's always this idea that there's a magic bullet to health. And, you know, the broken record version that we keep saying of eat more fruits and vegetables, eat more whole grains, eat more heart-healthy oils, beans, nuts, seeds, all of that gets drowned out sometimes in a sea of there's this new diet that's going to help you live another 15 years. And so I think that the American Heart Association, which really is viewed as a very credible source, wanted to have as much evidence out there as possible, communicated as clearly as possible to help really the whole public translate nutrition guidance into simple terms that resonate with their everyday lives.
So among the diets, swimming in the diet sea, I mean, you found paleo, ketogenic, and very low-calorie diets are unhealthy for hearts. What is problematic about these diets that we hear a lot about?
Yeah, also a really good question. And I think it's really two to threefold, really. So some of the major concerns about some of these patterns are that it encourages the avoidance of many of the food groups that are featured in that guidance that I mentioned in 2021 about what food groups are the, you know, most heart health promoting. So when you're avoiding whole grains and you're avoiding legumes and you're avoiding heart healthy liquid oils and often dairy, you're missing out on opportunities to introduce a lot of nutrients that are associated with health. And then additionally, you know, we all need to eat a certain number of calories each day to have enough energy. So what you tend to replace that with are higher fat meats, which are high in saturated fat that are not great for your heart, and other animal products. And then, you know, my personal bias as a registered dietitian and, you know, behavioral scientist too, is that sometimes when we try to follow very, very restrictive patterns for anything longer than 6 months, it's very difficult to adhere to that. and you start craving other foods. And so it makes it difficult to stay on something like that for the rest of your life. And really, the American Heart Association isn't asking people to try this new diet for the next 30 days. It's trying to say, this is how we want the public to live a healthy life.
This is how you eat for a lifetime. Yes. So the study notes some evidence showing keto and paleo diets improve heart health after 6 months, but the benefits disappear after a year. What might be happening there?
Well, I think, you know, we only really evaluated things for sort of for the general public rather than maybe specific disease states where there may be some benefit. But I think, again, when you restrict total calories, and we know that we have, you know, a problem in the U.S. with obesity, you might have some beneficial effects like improved cholesterol, maybe some weight loss. But then if you don't adhere to that over the longer term and you increase maybe some of the foods that you've been restricting and then you overconsume them, you could have weight regain, loss of energy, a lot of different things that could be happening.
So in terms of like paleo, if our Stone Age ancestors did it, you know, then why shouldn't we? I mean, I've heard that before. What are the specific concerns about meat-based diets alongside our heart?
Well, I always think that that's a very funny baseline comparison. You know, our life expectancy has increased a lot since our Stone Age ancestors. I'm not really sure that we want to go back to something that may not be as optimal for health. So, I mean, that's just kind of the first piece. But, you know, I think there's just consistent evidence that plant-based protein sources, and it's not to say that you can't have some meat, especially lean meats, but having a higher proportion of things like nuts, seeds, and legumes have beneficial compounds in them that help with lowering blood cholesterol, that may help with regulating blood pressure and reducing inflammation in the body, all of which are heart disease risk factors. Whereas high intake of particularly high fat animal proteins that are high in the types of fats, like saturated fat, that increases atherosclerosis or the hardening of arteries. It increases inflammation in the body. So all of those are heart disease risk factors. And that's not even just, you know, going apart from the idea that it's not really always a sustainable pattern either. So from the perspective of improving heart health, from the perspective of sustainability, shifting our proportion of protein to these plant-sourced foods can be a, you know, double win.
Registered dietitian and nutritional epidemiologist Maya Vadivelu explaining the American Heart Association's recent ratings of popular diets. Call in with a question or a comment along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Heart Association rates how closely some popular diets align with their guidance for heart-healthy eating. Be part of our conversation about diets like keto and paleo, DASH, other diets you've encountered. Call in with a question, your experiences with diets at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Maya Vadivelu, who is an associate professor of nutrition and food sciences at the University of Rhode Island and vice chair of this American Heart Association statement. Maya, for decades, nutritionists have warned that fat should be avoided. And then, you know, some researchers said, wait a minute, let's challenge that. There's advice out there, that advocates people should eat more saturated fats. Which fats are healthy? Which ones should people avoid?
So you're absolutely right that, you know, we had a movement on low-fat dietary patterns. And while it may have always been intended that when you were reducing total fat, you were increasing things like whole grains and fruits and vegetables and things of that nature, which is kind of how we put the pattern in low fat patterns that ended up in tier two of this statement. A lot of people ended up switching all fats for more refined grains, which really had the effect of increasing triglycerides and increasing cholesterol. And so what we really want to focus on is that unsaturated fats, which are rich in oils, especially non-tropical oils, so canola oil, olive oil, vegetable oils, and reducing intake of solid fats found in meat and in dairy products can really help with promoting better cholesterol and better triglyceride profiles, which are related to, again, the onset of heart disease.
And when you say, you know, there's been more movement toward more refined grains, what are some of the big culprits there?
I mean, like which foods have? Well, I mean, we see it in a lot of just foods with added sugar too. So whether it's, you know, when low fat movement came about, some of those things like the cookies that were fat free, but high in a lot of sugar, you know, honestly, sugar is found in so many different things. It's almost hard to keep track, whether you look at breakfast cereals, in some cases, a lot of different breads. It's an added ingredient. It's really infiltrated a lot of the food supply. So it's something that people need to be careful when they're looking at nutrition labels to see how much added sugar is in something. But, you know, white bread, you know, really white rice, a lot of the things that can be sort of staples in our diet, white flour tortillas, are the things that people ended up switching to because they're low in fat, but high in not necessarily the healthiest source of carbohydrates.
Question coming in here from JoJo in Appleton wants to know, JoJo has a nut allergy and is curious what they could use as a substitute.
As a substitute for nuts? Well, I, you know, without knowing more about the specific nut allergy, because there can be a difference between peanuts and tree nuts, you know, being very careful about which types of nuts and to avoid. Often, sometimes people who are allergic to nuts are not allergic to seeds. And so you can have sunflower seeds, and sun butter has been, you know, really popular in schools where there are high levels of peanut allergies, and people will substitute sun butter. And, you know, all of these patterns can be things where if you have a particular food allergy or other restriction or even just taste preference, where you can really adapt the guidance around that. So if, you know, nuts don't agree with you or you're allergic to them, choosing more beans, choosing fish and seafood some of the time, those can be ways of really working around everybody's different preferences, restrictions, and needs.
Let's turn to carbs. In recent years, carbs have been really singled out as the dietary evil monster. Are people now unfairly demonizing carbs the way they once shunned fats?
I absolutely think people are unfairly demonizing carbohydrates. In one of the fundamentals that you learn as a first-year nutrition student is that the brain prefers carbohydrate. And it's not to say that all carbohydrates are created equal. Carbohydrates are found in fruits. They're found in vegetables, albeit at slightly lower levels in the non-starchy vegetables. They're found in whole grains. They're found in dairy products. And really, if you look at that, that's the majority of food groups where you're finding carbohydrate, because our bodies are designed to use those to fuel our brain, to fuel our working muscles. They're also the sources that I mentioned, excluding dairy, the, you know, whole grains, the beans, the fruits and vegetables. Those also come with a lot of fiber, which have, you know, a ton of benefits for, you know, reducing total cholesterol. They have benefits toward cancer prevention. You know, it's just really, they also have benefits to satiety. So people feel fuller on less food, which makes it easier to regulate your body weight.
We're looking at a new study from the American Heart Association rating popular diets for heart health, and Maya Vadivelu is one of the study's authors and associate professor of nutrition at the University of Rhode Island. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your question. Barbara wrote in to ask, are high-protein drinks like Ensure and Premier Protein, are they healthy to use as occasional meal replacements or supplementation?
So I think for some of these, you know, meal replacement options, there's a question of instead of what. So, you know, if you're out and about and your choice is that, or having a milkshake, that's probably a better choice. But, you know, sometimes, you know, and after, you know, this comes up often with athletes where they're looking for a snack after a workout. And, you know, honestly, a glass of milk and a banana really does meet your protein needs. And often people don't need quite as much protein as they think. And so with something like Ensure, though, if there's a real need for it, from if you're an older adult and it's difficult to get enough calories, I think that's something that's useful to speak about with your doctor.
Of the diets you evaluated, which ones are healthiest for hearts?
So as intended, there are a lot of different patterns, and I think that was one of the more surprising things that are heart healthy. So like I said before, the DASH style pattern, which has rich in fruits and vegetables and low-fat dairy, the Mediterranean pattern, which many of us are familiar with, a lot of the vegetarian patterns, especially the ones that are a little bit more liberal. So like the pescatarian kind of pattern that includes fish, or an ovo-lacto or ovo-vegetarian where you are including dairy and or egg. All of those seem to have different versions that, again, were really rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy, nuts and seeds, heart healthy oils. And so there were a lot of different ways that you could adopt that pattern to reflect your needs and that would align with heart health.
We only have less than a second or less than a minute left, but what questions about nutrition are you hoping that dietitians like yourself, other researchers, can soon answer?
That's a really, really good question. I think what I'd like to know the most is how we can best support the public, whether it's through environmental changes, through delivering messages that really resonate with different communities, to move the needle, to make these patterns the thing that everybody thinks about when they think about heart health, rather than the introduction of new, you know, amazing diets that are suddenly going to change the world. If that did exist, then number one, I'd be out of a job, but I'd also be very comfortably retired.
Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maya Vadivelu is an associate professor of nutrition and food sciences at the University of Rhode Island, where she leads the Big Data and Eating Decisions Lab, was vice chair of this recent statement from the American Heart Association rating popular diets. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.